Hey, I'm Lauren LaGrasso. You are watching AfterBuzz TV, and I am here with Harvey Mason Jr. He's a Grammy Award-winning songwriter, producer, movie producer, you name it. He's done it. He's amazing. Stay tuned.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Tori Kelly. Mega talent. You produced this. You're the bomb. This man sitting next to me, he's a Grammy Award-winning songwriter, music producer, and movie producer who has worked with the likes of everybody from Tori Kelly, Jennifer Hudson, Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, pretty much everybody you admire and have longed to hear your whole life. I am so excited to talk with him today. Please welcome Harvey Mason Jr.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you.
Thank
good to
you.
Be here.
Oh, good to have you here.
I love your spot.
Oh, thank
Buzz,
you.
Buzz TV, huh?
Yeah, After Buzz. You got to keep it real. So,
I love it.
Harvey knows pretty much everything in the world of music, but I was schooling him on the world of After Buzz TV and after shows. So,
pretty
it's good.
Cool.
I thought I would solely be learning from you today, so it feels good to have a little back and forth.
I'm learning the world of after TV shows.
And yes.
I'm going to start watching and learning all about my favorite shows and what's really happening on the shows because I never know.
That's right. Well, that's why. Do you watch Game of Thrones?
I don't watch Game of Thrones, but there's a couple others that you mentioned that I can imagine you guys commentate on. So I got to check you guys out.
That's what it's good for. Especially sometimes you'll watch a show and none of your other friends are watching it. And it's like you have friends on the internet.
Right. And they can tell you what's really up.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about a certain show and you tell me if you do?
Yeah, please.
Actually, I'm going to mess up the name now. I can't remember. Westworld?
Steven, do we do Westworld?
No.
Steven?
Steven's like, no, we don't
no
do that
reply.
Shit.
Okay.
What about Stranger Things?
Yes. Okay. And actually, we do that one in collaboration with Netflix.
Okay.
So it's like produced with AfterBuzz TV and Netflix as a collaborative project. I love that show.
Perfect. Well, then I have to tune in because there's so much that I don't get and goes right over my head. I'm like, I got to find somebody who's an expert about this. So now I know where to go.
And you can watch live and chat with people. So you're going to like it.
Awesome.
But we got to hear all about you and your story as a human being, as an artist. Where did this start for you, Harvey? Because I know you were raised by two musicians. In Boston, you were born and you were raised out here, correct?
I was born in Boston. You know, my parents were both in college, actually going to music school, New England Conservatory of Music. And then my dad went to Berkeley as well. And I was born there and then moved to Los Angeles when I was, I think, two or a little less than two, 18 Aww. Months. So I don't really remember growing up in Boston at all. But that was my birthplace. So, yeah, I've lived here my whole life. I went away to college. But other than that, I've been here my whole life.
Wow. And did you know you wanted to do music from a young age?
I knew I wanted to be involved in music. I didn't really grasp, like, the concept of making a living or that being a job. I kind of just figured that's what everybody did, you know. My parents did it. And I was around it so much that it just felt very natural and just kind of seemed like, oh, okay, well, go to school and then start working on my music. But as I got older, I realized that it definitely is not just something that you stumble into. And we could talk more about that kind of as part of my path. But I always had a passion for music for sure. And I loved playing it. I loved listening to it and trying to make it all the way from the time I was, I think, 5 years old. I started taking piano lessons.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how long after you started taking piano did you start composing?
Right away. Yeah, because I hated playing all those old, crusty, classical songs.
That's the failure of so many teachers, I think.
Yeah, my teacher failed big time.
Yeah.
They were like, play this, and I was like, oh, I hate that music. Even though I appreciate it now, and I think it's amazing, and I'm glad I learned some of it.
Mm-hmm.
As a five-year-old, you want to, you know, play, like, the song you heard on the radio, so... I was lucky that my dad and mom were musical enough to the point where I could go with my piano teacher and study all the classic stuff and work on scales and all that sight reading stuff. And then when I got home, I could just make music and be creative. And so that was the good balance that worked out for me.
Do you remember your first song at all?
Probably not, but I remember the first song that was recorded professionally by another artist, and I think I was 9 or 10 years old, if you can believe that. And I should Google it at some point, but... The song was called Love Makes It Better. I have no idea why that was the title at 9 years old.
You knew. Back then you knew.
And it was recorded by Grover Washington Jr. And that was my first recording, like professional money-making recording. So.
Oh, wow.
That's on his record.
How did that opportunity come about?
My dad was playing drums for Grover's recording sessions and was going to the studio every day. And I was like, I love Grover Washington's music, Dad. I want to write him a song. And he said, okay, go ahead. And I wrote him a song. And then my dad's like, that's really good. And then he sat down and kind of like showed me a couple things and took it to work with him that day. And then he came back. He's like, hey, guess what? We recorded your song today. I was like, wow, great.
That, I think that's the most insane story I've ever heard. I mean, talk about a prodigy.
It's crazy, right?
It's something that's really meant to be. But I was listening to a couple interviews of you this morning. And one of them was when you first... You know, I think you finished college and you came back here.
Yep.
And you started really pounding the pavement. And you said it took you about 5 years to really get your songs through. So do you feel like what was the period like in between that 9-year-old success and when you're probably what, like 22, first trying to make it? Like, yeah. What was that period of your life like? And did you have a lot of successes? Did you doubt yourself? What was going on then as an artist and mentally?
Well, I always took music as an early stage in my life, I took music as a hobby and it was something that I enjoyed and I really loved. And mm-hmm. it wasn't at that point something I was planning on making a living out of. I was going to be a basketball player. And so like soon as after 9 or 10, I started playing sports as a kid, like everybody. Then going to high school, I was really good in basketball. And I was like, okay, my future is in sports, athletics. And music was a distraction and something fun that I did to kind of relax and unwind and just enjoy myself. So high school, again, playing basketball, high school All-American, ended up going to University of Arizona to play basketball there, played 4 years there. And my senior year in college, I tore my ACL on my knee, kind of a career-ending injury at that point. So I went back into playing music and really concentrating on music and creating music. I was really bummed because I'd played basketball my whole life. All my teammates were going on to the NBA. And I was sitting in my apartment with like a keyboard and a computer and just depressed. So I just started writing music. And that was the first time when I really said, okay, I have to focus on music and make this my career. Because, again, I'd always loved it. And it wasn't like I was settling for second best. But it was something else that I had a passion for and a talent for. So I was very fortunate to have more than one thing that I could do growing up as a kid. So that's kind of how I got to the point you're talking about where I was 21, just finished college, didn't know what I was going to do for a living, living in Arizona because I went to school there. And I was kind of trying to work my way back to LA. I couldn't afford to live here. I didn't have any opportunities to make music. No one was going to pay me to make music. So when I was in Tucson, I started a jingle music production company. So we did jingles for, you know, hamburger stores and break joints. And
so how would you make that work? Would you write them and then call the companies, or what was that process like?
I started the company and set it up and started doing meetings, and I would go around to all the companies and say, hey, you know, let's improve your advertising with some music.
That's
and,
brilliant.
Yeah.
Do you think that could still work today?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of people that still do it today. There's a guy, I sold my company to a guy when I left Arizona, and he still, I don't know if he still does it, but there's still people doing it.
Nice.
Definitely. So I also went to the radio stations, and you know, when they're selling advertising, they are a lot of times producing their clients' commercials. So mm-hmm. I would do music through that. And then my girlfriend, who's now my wife, my girlfriend was working at an ad agency. So they would sometimes need music for their TV spots. So that's kind of how I got back into music as a profession, or considered it a profession. And doing that really gave me great training because it's so many different types of music, so many different genres. You're working with an advertising agency or a client or a radio station executive, so you're kind of doing something creative, but you're also serving other people's needs.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good training.
That kind of set you up for the pop industry as well, you know, because it is a business at the end of the day, and you are appealing to a consumer.
Right.
So it's interesting how, even though, I mean, it's probably much more of a creatively expressive experience writing a full-length song. It's probably a transferable skill set.
It is, and I think the skill set transfers more to working in film and TV than in pop music. But what did translate was the ability to do a lot of different styles of music and do stuff quickly, kind of within a budget, and just know what your resources were and how to put them to good use. And so once I started writing songs, I had all this flexibility because I had done, you know, a little bit of rock, country, rap, R&B, and I could pull from all those different styles of music and put it into my song. So I thought that was really useful.
And how did you build the bridge back to LA after that?
Well, I was saving my money and recording all these commercials. And I think we ended up doing a couple of big national spots. One for Coca-Cola, one for Mattel Toys, and that gave us some good money into the company. And on weekends and like a couple days a week, I would drive to LA with all my music because while I was writing commercials, I was still writing songs, like mm-hmm. trying to perfect writing great, you know, hit records. So I would drive to LA for 2 or 3 days at a time and try and hustle my songs, hustle my demos to label reps, artists, lawyers, managers, anybody I could find. And back in those days, it was like cassette tape. So I would drive around throwing my cassettes at people. I would meet people in parking lots.
And were you bold about it, or were you
I was totally bold.
You're bold.
Yeah.
Do you recommend, let's say somebody is approaching you, how would you recommend they approach you? Would you recommend they do it the way you did it, or is there...
Well, it's different. You don't have to do that anymore. Send somebody an email with a link or you know, an attachment. It's very easy. Before, you didn't know how to reach anybody. You couldn't find any. There was no like way to get to an A&R person. I ended up going down to Sony Records and waiting outside in the parking lot and then watching when the good cars would come out. I'm like, oh, that's a nice car. That's got to be a high level exec. And I ended up following the president. At the time, his name was Ron Sweeney. He had a convertible Rolls Royce. And I followed him. And just before we got to his house, he got to a red light. And I pulled up next to him and I threw my cassette in the back seat of his car. And so I did that, I don't know how many times. I found out where he lived, put stuff in his mailbox. I mean, I was really crazy.
Did he get scared ever?
No, because I always just told him I was, hey, I'm a hustling songwriter, producer, you know, and I was not threatening looking, and I wasn't like with a big posse of people, and I just had my little cassettes.
I just love that you threw it in the back seat. Like,
well, he wouldn't take it. I was handing it to him. He wouldn't take it, and he's like, no, I got to go. So I just threw it in his car. But I did a lot of that, and I did a lot of just hanging out backstage at concerts and hotel lobbies. Mm. But now it's easy. You know, you find the internet, you go on, find somebody's email address, send them a song, send them a link. You got a SoundCloud. There's a million ways to get your music heard by people. So it's a really different time. So, mm-hmm. but people that like to approach me, I always take emails. I always take submissions that way.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So you did that. What was the moment where you had the big break that really led you to the rest of your career?
There's a couple of moments, but one in particular was on one of my trips to Los Angeles. I was still living in Tucson, and I had met a guy through a guy who worked at Motown Records, and he agreed to meet with me, which was a miracle because it's so hard to get meetings. And so I went up there with all my cassettes and a little, you know, briefcase. And so I said, let me play some of my songs. And he kind of nodded his head at a couple of them. He said, okay, it's pretty good, but let me play you something. So he played me some of the artists that he was A&Ring their records, putting their mm-hmm. records together. And one of them was an artist named Joe. I don't know if you ever remember Joe, but he was a kind of a popular guy in the 90s. And I listened to the Joe record, and it was so good, and the sounds were so amazing, and the songwriting was a whole nother level, and the singing was crazy. And so this guy, he told me, he said, until your songs sound like those or better, don't come back. And that really struck a chord with me, and I said, okay, I understand. This is really serious. This is mm-hmm. competitive, and you... Obviously, that guy's job depends on how good of a song he picks for his artist. So he's not going to pick somebody just because he likes them or he thinks they're nice guys. He's looking for quality. And so once he did that, I went back to Arizona. I didn't come back to LA for 6 months because I saw and I realized and recognized for the first time that I had some kind of room to grow. I had a long ways to go until I was mm-hmm. at that level. And I think, not to get off topic, but that's what happens nowadays with the ease or the ability for everybody to make music, they all think it's good and they don't really spend time comparing themselves or really, really analyzing, okay, what am I competing with?
You have to be a consumer too, right?
You have to be a consumer and you have to be smart. It's not just creating art in your own vacuum and just for fun. Like, you have to be smart. Who's the song for? Who am I trying to attract? But anyways, back to that moment, he really, really turned my career because I started paying attention to everything else and realizing the bar is set there and you have to go above and beyond the bar.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So with writing, have you ever read Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art?
Mm-mm.
It's amazing. But he says there is no excuse good enough not to get up and do your art. He's like, I don't care if I have the stomach flu. I'm getting up and I'm writing that day.
Yeah.
Do you look at writing like that, where you have to be so committed to it? Like, even if you're not making a living, commit to it like a job?
No, I don't actually subscribe to that. To me, that turns it into a job. You know, for me, it's not a job. It's so fun. And so when I feel great, I write great feeling songs. When I feel depressed, I write sad songs. But if I don't feel like writing, I don't write. You know, and that's just my philosophy. there's a lot of really successful people that do that. I mean, tons. I just finished George Lucas's book, and he does that. When he's writing a movie, he goes up to his loft at 8 o'clock, and he doesn't come out until 6 o'clock every day, no matter what. Diane Warren, another songwriter that writes a lot of huge hits, she writes every day religiously. So just different strokes for different folks. I don't find it – I don't want to turn it into a job, and I don't want to make it mandatory. So I write quite often, but it's not like – factory worker style.
I think that's good. Because that was one of the pivotal moments to switch over to sing for a minute. That was one of the pivotal moments in the movie where I felt like once the main character, the little koala bear, once he started doing it for the love versus like, we have to make this work, we have to make this work, that's when everything fell into place and that's when he had that huge success.
Exactly.
So I think that when you really commit to being your best self and your best artist, that's when you can have those breakthroughs. And I think maybe if you're letting it be more organic, like you're describing, you're going to get to that even more quickly.
I hope so. I mean, I think that's the case. I think in our culture and our society right now, it's just not set up that way. And I think everybody has the first goal and objective is to make money and get famous and get on the internet.
Instagram.
Get some jewelry or a nice car. And I've seen that happen over the last 20 years where people that I used to run into a while back, they just loved music so much. They just couldn't do anything besides make music. That's all. I mean, if they didn't make music, they would just stop living, you know. Now it's more like, okay, what can I do to get a lot of followers, or what can I do to make a lot of money? In music, oh, yeah, let me try that. In modeling, oh, maybe that. Or, you know, fashion or comedy. Or, you know, they just jump around. And there's not that desire, that, like, life driving force to make music because you have to. There's a few, I think, exceptions, but I find more people are into it for the fame and the celebrity.
Who would you say are the exceptions right now?
Wow. Well, I think most of the artists that get to a certain level of greatness are doing it for the right reasons, and that's why it comes through in their art. You know, the Beyoncés and, you know, I don't know, all the different names, John Legend. You know, the people that are doing great things are generally pure of heart. You know, they're not doing it so they can get rich. But I was thinking more along the lines of people coming into the business. I think those are the people that I was more speaking of, where they see the video or they see things online or they see, you know, people on tours and jets and they're like, oh, I want that lifestyle. I want that lifestyle. And they don't know how to get there. And they think music is one vehicle.
They see A to Z, but they don't see all the letters in between.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
It's very true.
So they're thinking that those are right next to each other, when really there's just so much hard work, passion, blood, sweat, and tears that go into those middle steps.
And as you said, if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, I don't think you'll be your best self as an artist. I just really think your mind, and it, not to sound too mystical, but I think your brain and your creative force is not at its full potential when you're thinking about other things and when you're thinking about making money and thinking about how can I get famous. I think you really have to let that go and just be open to creating something special.
So for new artists who do come from that state of mind, what is the best way for them to start to break into the business if they're not like, oh, I need to get all these followers? If they're just committed to their art, what do you think is the best way for them to break in? Because I feel like even with my job, you know, I work as a producer in radio, and that's always something that's asked. How many followers do they have?
Of course.
You know, but it doesn't speak to talent always. So how do they bridge that gap?
Well, I think the focus should be to make great art. And that leads to the followers. I don't think you're wanting to find followers and then you're seeing what can I do to get them. I think it starts with what you're creating. It starts with making a great piece. If you're a songwriter or a singer, making a great piece of music, there's nothing wrong with getting followers. That's obviously the objective. You want fans, you want people to hear your music, and you want success. But to me, it starts with, what am I doing and why am I doing it? Am I doing it because I love it? Am I doing it because I think this is what I believe in? Or am I doing it for artificial reasons, just for followers? You know, the followers are going to come if you're doing something great. You put yourself out there and people like it, they're going to jump on board.
That's sound advice, Harvey.
Thank
you, sir. So you've worked with, I've named just a couple of them, but I mean, pretty much everybody huge.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate.
You're very talented too. And I think you've got a real eye for talent and for creating environments where that can thrive to its highest potential.
Yep.
out of every experience you have, is there one in your mind that stands out?
No, no way. I've had so many crazy experiences, and we always talk around my building that we should be writing a book, because every week there's like a crazy experience.
Well, I was envisioning a movie based on your life when you're telling me all this. I actually see it happening.
It would be nuts. There's probably a few producers that have my level of craziness, but it's even exaggerated, so they would probably be better for a movie. But I've had some amazing experience, and I've got the chance to work with a lot of people that I grew up idolizing or loving. Yeah. So those are always just like the wildest experiences, you know, sitting in the studio and watching Whitney Houston sing one of my songs, or Michael Jackson, or Aretha Franklin, you know, things like that are amazing. And then being around kind of the new up-and-comers that always blow me away when I see somebody like 14 or 15 years old where they have this freakish talent that you're like, where does that come from? You know, I started with Chris Brown when he was 14. Tori Kelly was 13 when I started working with her.
Really?
So just seeing stuff like that is an amazing experience. Working with Justin Timberlake, people like that who are kind of like freaks of nature where they're so talented and you're just like scratching your head. How do they do that? Why are they so good at everything? You know, acting, sports, singing, comedy is like, you know, and I've had a lot of experiences with people like that. And so it's just always been, every day is like a crazy adventure for me and my job.
When you're working with someone who is that talented, how do you go about giving them notes? Like, do you have to kind of like figure out the energy of the room and then figure out how they communicate? How do you get in there with your producer notes?
Well, I think that's why I've been able to continue working, and I've kind of made a reputation for myself as being somebody who can deal with those type of people really well.
Right. You can joke with them, right?
Different ones. I think, like you said, you have to gauge the room. You have to, more than anything, you have to understand the artist personality. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I'm working with like high level divas. You know, their artists are crazy.
Yeah, they are
really divas.
I've really found that from this year, because I met so many famous people over the last year, and I'm like, wow, they're crazy. They really are.
But that's what makes them special. Brilliant. And really great at something. Mm-hmm. And so over the years I've had a lot of practice of working with, you know, a lot of different personalities, and I guess the trick is to really be able to quickly assess what type of person they are, how to best motivate them, how to best get from them what you need. Because ultimately, I'm not there to befriend them or like hang out and go to lunch. I'm there to get a performance.
Your duties to the song, to the album. Song,
to the artist, too. Mm-hmm. My duties to them, even though sometimes they don't know that. Mm-hmm. They, like, I'm coaching them to victory, hopefully, I would like to say. And they're the player, I'm the coach. The trick is to figure out what can I do to make them play their best game they've ever played. And so that's, as you said, to your point, like, you got to figure that out quickly. Sometimes they need coddling. You're patting them on the back. You're like, oh, that sounds amazing. So good. Do it. Try it one more time. Try it like this. Or sometimes you have to get mad and get an attitude with them. Sometimes you have to make them upset. Sometimes you need to stop working and, you know, sit down and say, you know, let's take a break. And this isn't sounding as good as I was hoping. And sometimes they get an attitude and get, you know, upset with me, and then that pisses them off and they start singing better. You know, there's all kinds of different ways that you have to go about getting them to deliver that vocal. But I know for a fact at the end of the day, or at the end of the week, or however long the session is, the vocal that I have from them is going to be their best vocal. And that's my goal. And whether they love me or hated me, when they listen back to the record or see themselves on the film, they're going to be like, that Harvey, he really pissed me off, but I sound really good, and I love that. I want to work with him again, you know?
Yeah.
So we had a lot of, I mean, Whitney and I fought like cats and dogs, and I've had that experience with a lot of people, but I loved her, and she loved me, and we had a great relationship. But it's rocky when you're trying to create something, and especially working with somebody like that who's so great and so confident and knows what they are as an artist, but a lot of times they're in their own world and they need somebody to bring it out, or to guide them or funnel them in the right direction. And Aretha's the same way. She's like, Harvey, I want to do it like this. And I'm like,
I was going to ask you, because as a Detroiter, like, we hear so many different things about her. Like, what is she really like to work with, and how do you coach her?
It's the same way, you know, it depends on the day, depends on the song, depends on her mood. But I know one thing for a fact, she's amazingly talented.
Yeah,
she has a crazy voice, one of the best voices of all time. And she's very sweet. You know, she's a very nice lady, offers to cook food for you, and always sends gifts and flowers. And she's very thoughtful. She can be tough because she knows what she wants, and she knows what her voice can do and what sounds good. She's had a lot of years of experience and practice. So with her, my job was to just gently try and add, not subtract, you know, just try and make things slightly better. And there's a lot of funny stories about Aretha and myself and her getting mad at me and talking to Clive, and Harvey is the worst. And then the next time, you know, we work together and her record sounds great and we get back together and she thanks me and we go on about our business. So I really love working with Aretha. She's fun and she's a challenge. That's what I like about her. She's a challenge.
Oh, so you like a challenge.
Of course. Yeah, I love a challenge.
Huh. Very interesting. What do you think about the way she sings the national anthem? Do you approve?
Oh, I totally approve. The last anthem was, what was that? Was it the football game?
It may have been the Lions game, actually.
Yeah, it was the Lions game, because I remember she had the winter outfit on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not as traditionally worried about the anthem as a lot of people are, so I might be the wrong person to ask. I just appreciate the musicianship and the creativity that goes into it. So in that sense, I thought it was amazing, and I loved it. And to have a legend like Aretha, even in our midst, to be able to do something like that, I think we all should be thankful. Whether you liked it or not, you have to appreciate like how amazing it is to have somebody like Aretha with her history and just kind of the background that she brings. And there's not a lot of people like that left walking the planet, you know, and slowly but surely they're leaving us. So I think we always tend to wait until after people pass to really appreciate them. And I think with Aretha, at least the way I look at it, is I'm just excited every time I get a chance to hear her sing.
Yeah, she is a living legend, that is for sure.
She is.
And speaking of people, too many who have passed, you worked with Whitney, and you spoke to it briefly, Whitney and Michael, right before they passed away. So what was that experience like, and did you see the end coming?
No, not with either of them. No, not at all. And they were both amazing to work with. I had great experiences with Whitney. I was with her on Thursday, and I think she passed on Saturday. It was the last session, you know, she did, and we were working on a film called Sparkle, and we were talking about her new record that we were just getting ready to get started on, and she was really excited about Sparkle and the movie and her performance. She acted in it as well, and she gave a great performance. So she was really excited, in a great mood, great spirits. She came in the control room, we were dancing around to one of her songs and having fun. It's one of the days she wasn't mad at me, so that was good.
I was going to say, it's nice that you ended on a high note. Maybe literally.
On a super high note. Super high note. And she said, I'll see you on Saturday. We were going to like sit around near each other at the party. And so, no, I did not expect that one. And then Michael, some time had passed since I worked with him when he died. But I did work on his last record with him. So at that point, he was, you know, he has a lot of things that he was dealing with. He is a very private person. He's more shy than anything. People mistake his shyness for, you know, being, you know, caught up or have an attitude, and it's not really that. I think he's really shy, or he was really shy, and he was a little bit embarrassed of kind of a lot of things that had happened to him and events that had taken place. So I think that made him more of a recluse than anything else. Not that he was like afraid of germs or anything weird like that. So I really loved working with Michael, and he was a really generous guy. And again, obviously a musical genius, but really nice person, good person, and really heartbreaking that he's not here.
Is it true that he would sing out all the parts? Wow.
Yeah, that's true. And the music that we did, not so much, because we had done a lot of the production before he even heard the tracks, but previous to that, and then on any song that we worked with him where the song was started from scratch, he would sing out parts and, you know, kind of beat the rhythm, beatbox it, and I mean, he's amazing. He's amazing. No one else like him in the world.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I was going to, there'll never, ever be anyone like him again.
There'll be someone else that'll be incredible and amazing, but not like that.
Yeah.
He was too good. And photographic memory for musical things, he would tell us, you know, or 2 months ago on Thursday, we sang that song, and on the bridge in the second bar, there was a little woo that I did. Can you go back and find it? And I would go back through the tapes, and it would be right there. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's amazing.
That is amazing.
Yep.
Okay, we have to get to a little bit of sing before we wrap out here.
Yeah.
So you're the executive music producer on this film. What does that job entail? Because from watching it, which I loved it so much, you, if you're watching, you must go see this movie. You will cry, you will laugh. But
you'll
like,
sing.
You'll sing. I did. I was singing. Probably everyone else in the movie theater hated me. But tell me exactly what this job entailed and how you got involved in the project.
I got involved about 2.5 years ago. The filmmakers were looking for somebody to help them wrangle all this music. There's so much music, and it's about music, basically. Mm-hmm. So I'd done Straight Outta Compton for Universal and did all the music for that. And so we were kind of right on the heels of that, and Universal was the same studio doing Sing. So I met with the director and the head of the studio, and they brought me on board. They had most of the songs already picked out, so I helped pick some of the songs, but mostly my job was trying to adapt all the songs to the characters and, mm-hmm. and have them fit in the movie in kind of an organized way, give each character kind of their own sound musically, you know, genre-wise, and then work with the cast on all their singing performances. And in total, I think it was 65 or 68 songs, something like that in the film. So as executive music producer, my role was to get those from basically nothing, starting with a blank canvas, doing all the production, the music, working the arrangements so they fit to what the director wanted, length, time, dynamic, mm-hmm. you know, story build, emotional feel, and then finishing the production, getting with the actor, getting them to deliver the lines in the context of, again, what the director wanted, what their character was going through at the time, figuring out how that all fits into the song, and then taking those performances, mixing them, and making them sound like they're either in the theater or, you know, the bedroom, wherever they are, and just kind of putting them in context. So that's executive music producer.
That's amazing. That is a lot.
It's a lot of darn work.
Did that take, you said, two years? Yeah. 2 years, yeah. I'm surprised you got it done that fast. I feel like you ran 17 marathons just now when you were talking about all that. That's insane.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And the animators were doing a lot, too, because while I was doing music, they're animating to... We filmed on video everything. So even when a guy's playing the guitar for one of my sessions, we film it. And then we send it to the animators, and the guy, the band in the background will be, like, really playing the guitar. And Johnny the Gorilla plays a piano solo. Like, we film the hands of the piano player, and they totally match it. So they were... I mean, it's amazing what they do on animation now. Crazy.
So you say your specialty is basically, I mean, you've got a lot, but one of them is taking actors who aren't traditionally singers and making them sound like singers.
Yes.
How do you facilitate that?
I was lucky on this one because everybody was really a good singer. Reese had done some vocals before, and Scarlett had been in a band before. Obviously, Seth MacFarlane is a great singer. So it wasn't hard with this. But generally, when you're working with someone who's not a great singer, you're just kind of trying to make them comfortable. You're trying to prepare them for success, give them enough time to rehearse, work with them outside the studio. And then once you get in the studio, there's a million little technical tricks. I can't tell you all my tricks to learn.
Oh, darn, Harvey. I thought I was going to learn something from you. No, I learned a lot. So do you have any say in the casting, or is it all like they just give you the actors? Okay.
I actually had a tiny bit of say in the casting of this. There was one character in particular that I helped bring to the table, but I won't let you know which one. But, you know, that's this done at a higher level than the director and all those people generally have an idea for who they want. Sometimes they would ask me, what do you think of this person musically? And I'm working on another show right now. I'm actually just starting Pitch Perfect 3. And so we're doing a lot of casting of that just last week. So they would ask my opinion, like, Harvey, what do you think about this singer? Do you think they could pull off these songs? Mm-hmm. So that I'm a little bit involved in that sense.
Nice.
Yep.
And out of every scene and song in the movie, which one do you think turned out the best? Which one were you most proud of?
Well, I've told the story before, so maybe you've heard it, but there's probably two. Don't You Worry About a Thing I love. There's three. Golden Slumbers I love at the beginning and middle and end because it's such a cool use of that song. And Jennifer Hudson did an amazing vocal performance. But probably my favorite, and this is so backwards, is Hallelujah, because we had done this big string arrangement and piano and beautiful arrangement. And then she sang it. And then we got it to the director and it got on the mix stage. And he's like, get rid of all the music. And I was initially crushed. I was like, oh, this is like one of my favorite pieces. And I was so excited to hear it. And it ended up being one of my favorite parts of the movie when she's standing up on the top of that hill singing the song, just a cappella. No,
it's
music.
Like, it's making me tear up right now because I'm thinking about it.
Big time. It makes me tear up every time. Even when I hear it without the visual, I tear up. And so that ended up being one of my favorites, even though they erased all my music.
Oh, Tori, I mean, gosh,
she's special.
Yeah, but we were just saying, and we're not positive she's human because that level of talent doesn't seem human.
She's so normal is the only reason I think she's kind of human. But if she wasn't that normal, I would really question, like, where she was from or what.
Right.
And I know her parents, so I know she probably is human, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, she came from somewhere. I remember I saw her in concert. I didn't know who she was, and I was like, Who is this girl? Yeah. And then her lyrics are so rich, too. I remember there was something like, maybe I can still be a singer if I don't take off my clothes. I'm like, okay, I'm sold.
Yeah, she's a killer.
Yeah, she's a great example for anyone.
And she's been at it since she was 13. So anybody who's trying to be an artist or trying to be a musician, pay attention to things like that. You know, she does not quit. She doesn't stop. She's been through, I think, 3 record deals. You know, she deserves to be really, really huge. And I think she still has ways to go, but I think she's going to get there.
Yeah. And just to completely circle back as we wrap this out, that was a long trajectory for her. And she's one of the most talented human beings alive.
She is.
So don't give up if you're out there. Keep working, though, and get back to why you're doing this in the first place. And I think that's what the thesis statement of this film was for me.
Right.
Get to the love and you'll get to your success and keep going.
Be persistent. Mm-hmm. There's going to be sacrifices. Mm-hmm. There's going to be roadblocks, you know, bumps in the road. But if you're passionate about it and you love it and you're doing it for the right reasons, I'm 100% sure it will work out.
Harvey, thank you.
Thank you. It's so fun to be here. I would talk all day.
I would too. I mean, hey, Diana said we have to wrap at 1:40. I've already kept you 4 minutes over, but I could literally sit here and pick your brain all day. You're fascinating.
Thank you.
You calm me down. You've got a great energy. Good. And you were involved in this film that really, really touched my life. So I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Very nice of you to say.
Thank you. It's true.
Maybe I can come back.
Please. Yeah, anytime. Like anytime you have something to promote, just let me know. I'd love to have you on. Also, everyone listening, please follow this man. He is a gem of a human being. He's at Harvey Mason Jr. on Twitter and Instagram, harveymasonmedia.com, and you have this amazing charity I'd love to talk about sometime, too, called Heroes of Hope. It's a Heroes of Hope race, and it's benefiting brain tumor research, and it's in honor of your daughter. Is that correct?
Yeah, she had brain cancer.
Wow.
And she's survived, obviously, and doing really, really well. She's,
volleyball player? You know,
plays volleyball at the University of Arizona on the sand volleyball team. Yeah, she's a sweetheart.
That's too cool. So you two kind of had twin lives.
Well, my son played basketball at the University of Arizona, too. So we really had twin lives. And my wife played volleyball at the University of Arizona, too. So the 4-pack.
Wow.
Scary.
Kind of cool, though.
That's another show.
That's another show. We'll get to the 4-pack on the next show. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Lauren LaGrasso, and you can find me at Lauren LaGrasso on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I'm at Lolo Logra on Snapchat if you want to kick it old school with me. I'm playing a show next week on Wednesday at Now Boarding in West Hollywood, so you can check my Instagram and all those places for that. And check out Sing. It is an incredible film. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.